Welcome to A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing. Pam is unable to join us today, so I shall be flying solo with the welcome addition of three wonderful guests. Regal House authors, David R. Roth, Lorraine Herring, and Michelle Herman. David R. Roth studied creative writing at New York University, the American University in Paris, and Drexel University's Story Lab before receiving his MFA from Cedar Crest College's Pan-European program. His short stories have appeared in Passenger Journal, Moss, and Every Writer. The Femme Fatale Hypothesis is his debut novel. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Jane. You really appreciate being here.
Lorraine Herring's newest book, A Constellation of Ghosts, a speculative memoir with ravens, was released from Regal House in 2021. She's a tenured professor of psychology, focusing on grief and bereavement studies. Thank you for joining us, Lorraine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michelle Herman writes fiction, poetry, columns, and essays, and has been published widely in newspapers and literary journals. She is the recipient of several writing awards and is a longtime writing teacher and developmental editor. Save the Village, released on February 11th, is Michelle's debut novel. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks so much, Janie. Glad to be here.
I'd like to begin our discussion with a thought-provoking quote by Antea Strubel, a German writer and literary critic who wrote eloquently of the role of death in literature. Quote, "We tell ourselves stories in order to live," Joan Didion wrote in one of her essays. She did not mean that we tell stories to entertain ourselves. Storytelling is not a pastime or embellishment. Telling is existential, a buffer against the gnawing knowledge of that black non-being. Death is relegated to the outskirts by the act of telling, or rather what is referred to as death, emptiness, chaos, non-being. The act of telling brings order into the catastrophic chaos. Telling stories guides us away from death, and more importantly, it guides us in general. It gives us direction and support, unquote. So if the purpose of philosophy is to prepare us for death, or to be the practice of death, as Socrates put it, then we might ask, what is the relationship between death and literature? How can literature contribute to our existential concerns regarding death as a characteristically private experience and a real loss in our lives? Can literature help us face or conceive this most definitive of all endings? So I'd like to start with you, David, and I'm wondering first whether you agree with Strubel's interpretation, whether you ever thought of the femme fatale hypothesis as a guide in this regard, and indeed what inspired you to tackle this topic as comprehensively as you did in your recently published novel?
Well, we're going to start with the small stuff, right?
That's right.
I agree 100% with the quote in many aspects of it as well, not just the general tenor of it. I believe that we die pretty much as we live. If you live in fear, you're going to be fearful of death, because death is purely, you know, the last act of our life. And I've been doing a lot of reading about death as a result of taking on this topic that I broached in the Femme Fatale hypothesis, because I wanted to get different people's perspectives on, one, how we live our lives leading up to death, why we have such a trouble talking about it, why it is such a problematic issue for most people, even though, you know, Joan Didion and many philosophers may find some comfort in death and in writing about it. But I think most of us have a little bit of a trauma around it, you know, when we lose others, when we lose our pets, when we face our own death. And so when I was first setting out to write what became the Femme Fatale Hypothesis, I was really writing about life. I was really writing in the beginning about the life of an aging man, which I know quite a bit about. What I was really getting at first was not necessarily heading towards the end. Mortality, yes, but not necessarily the death part. But this took several years to gestate and then to turn into a novel. And in that time, I had to deal with a lot of death in my life. And watching those deaths, both good and bad, made me really think about the end, which is very much why this conversation is about not just writing about mortality, but writing about the end. And so I really felt that I needed to get at how people feel about death as a problem within our society, you know, particularly our society. how people think about it and try to push it off. And of course, you start back with philosophy. You start with philosophy, and you can go talking about the fear of death is it's rife throughout discussions of philosophy. And Ernest Becker wrote about denial of death as being literature, like writing, artwork, as being a, basically a form of denying death, not necessarily, you know, celebrating or warding it off, as Didion seemed to think. But he really was writing about it as an attempt to deny death, leave something behind, you know, to outlive death, essentially. I think there's a much healthier approach can be had. And so people like Stephen Jenkinson and a couple other people I've been reading have given me a much healthier view of death going forward.
Michelle, Lorraine, what do you guys think about the quote there? What are your feelings regarding that?
As a psychologist and also an artist and a writer, I feel like stories are one of our best and most profound ways of understanding other experiences and trying to make sense of the world that we find ourselves in. They're almost like a medicine in a way for what's going to happen to all of us. And, you know, what got me passionate about death and dying and grieving was rooted in the silences that we have in our culture around it, and in my family in particular. And it seemed like it was the single experience that all of us are going to go through. And we really needed to do better at having a dialogue and having a space for that.
Yes, great point. David, do you have an excerpt from the femme fatale hypothesis you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, so just to step back into that discussion about the motivation for writing the story in the first place, it was for this particular discussion, it would have been very easy for me to pick out one of the sections of the book where death is very much foremost. But what I wanted to do instead to sort of tee up the conversation, since we're early here, is I want to read a section where it's much more about how we look at life. And it's there's two characters at this point who are engaged. And one of them is the next door neighbor to Kelsey and Rose, who are the main protagonists in the story. Kelsey and Rose are the aging couple next door to June. And Kelsey, because his wife is dying and is very much bedridden at this point and has very little time outside of her room, when he's outside of his room, he's taking a great interest in his neighbor all of a sudden. And so in this particular scene, he's helping her build a raised bed garden. And what comes out of that, when she mentions to him that she's aware that he has an anniversary coming up, his response is that, yes, they've been together. He and his wife have been together for 47 terrifying years. And she's taken aback by that and doesn't find terrifying a very good description of a long marriage. And he says that it's not terrifying because of the actual marriage or the relationship, but because that the years have passed and that they're not going to make 48 years together. And that's when June steps in and says, I suppose that's one way to look at it. The way she says it suggests to Kelsey, she thinks it's precisely the wrong way to look at it. He lines up and drills another pilot hole, then says, I'm not sure there's another way to view the rolling out of life's ball of string. It's an unrelenting process of diminution, is it not? Rose is teaching us that, don't you think? June rearranges the screws she's holding so that they're all facing the same way. No, I don't think that. She gives Kelsey a look that he sees as genuine concern, as if she feels sorry for him. Is the most delicate contradiction Kelsey has ever experienced. Of course you don't, he says. Your eyes are still reliable. Your joints still don't talk back. June is not amused. You may not believe it, but my knees do complain. Despite that, I think there are little wonders revealed with age, things we could never know when we were younger. Kelsey sets one buttock on a 2x8 and rests the drill on his thigh. These wonders, as you call them, don't result in a rolling out of more time. One moment we notice something that has likely been presented to us 1,000 times before with little or no notice on our part, say, for example, the way the moon looks at a particular time of year, or the subtle colors of a female cardinal, or the scent of cinnamon. We thrill at our noticing, assign it some grand significance, and then off we go to the next moment, our little wonder rapidly receding into the neuronal netherworld where memories go to die, only to be reconstructed as something new in some future moment. June cocks her head at him and says, that's a very odd perspective coming from a man who spent his life fascinated by the tiniest details of nature. Kelsey concedes her point with a shrug. But I'm not talking about those things, June says. I'm thinking of what we learn about ourselves. You and Rose are very lucky to have had a long life together. I see that as something that makes you more, not less. I try to think of what I receive from each day, not what it takes away. Memories are memories. Today is today. Okay, Kelsey says, not entirely sure he understands. But nature is rather clear on this point. Whatever you think of the moments that came before today, we have fewer moments left. That's the terrifying bit.
Wonderful. David, thank you. That was great. One thing for me that came up in your selection there, which was marvelous, was it brought to mind for me the way in which literature has the power to freeze life to a certain moment. You know, when you're talking about the cardinals and that very moment of immersion and all of the hubbub and life that is in the garden. That's kind of a marvelous thing too, that fiction plays a vital role in, I think, is just reminding us of the joy and beauty and indeed the transience of life. And that's an important counterpoint, I think, to the notion of finality of things.
Absolutely. And let me just say one quick thing and then let others jump in. But I think this goes back to your initial quote, where a lot of what they were really saying in their philosophical and literary way was that literature and the attention to detail, paying attention, which is what if I were a teacher of writing, one of the main things I would tell my students to do is simply pay attention. And when you do pay attention and look out your window and see all the different things you can see, you see that life is quite a miracle. our opportunity to live it is really quite astounding just in the little things that you can experience every day. And I think writing about that and thinking about it and crafting sentences about that is quite a celebration of life. I don't think it's a putting off of death. I think it's really a celebration of life.
I agree entirely. And this reminds me of the section in Michelle Herman's novel, Save the Village, where she describes the immediate aftermath of the violent beginning of her book. And I'm going to let you expound upon that, Michelle. But she describes very simple items, you know, as part of this debris that is recovered from the post-bombing in Washington Square. These everyday items are imbued with an incredible poignancy because they're so representative, of course, of these lives that are so traumatically cut short. Michelle, you can speak better to that than I. Would you like to talk a little bit about how in Save the Village, you start off the novel with sudden tragic death, but the story that flows is focused on a protagonist who is only casually acquainted with the people who die. What inspired you to start your novel with such an act of destructive and deadly violence? Could you speak to that?
I'd be happy to. I didn't start the novel that way. I felt I was a bit timid in my fiction writing over the years, and I was taking a master class quite a few years ago, and the teacher talked about putting your characters in harm's way, that's something you have to let yourself do, even if it's terrifying, because in some way it makes you feel that you're putting yourself in the last place that you want to be, in harm's way. So I did that in part as a matter for my own self in organizing the book. And as I tried to distinguish between the craft reasons I had for doing it and the thematic reasons I had for doing it, they all kind of blended together. One of the motivations, this novel was conceived not all that recently, when the events of 9/11 and the aftermath were still a little bit fresher in my mind. I was here in the village through that whole experience. And what stuck with me almost more than the almost 3,000 lives that were lost was the beauty of being alive in the village, in my little community during that time. I felt everybody was just wide open in a way that they're not usually. Everybody's defenses were down. Everybody was speaking honestly and from the heart. Everybody was feeling their feelings. And those days in the week that followed were so crystalline, both in that beautiful fall weather we had, but also in that each day was so distinct and took on such a clear personality. And so thematically and in terms of organizing this big mess that was going to become a novel, I thought I wanted to start it with something something like that, not as big and not with big global implications, but I wanted a week when something really huge and tragic happened so that my characters would be compelled to open up in ways that they weren't otherwise open. And so that I could organize the novel in terms of those days that followed. And I gave, you know, I have chapter headings, but I have these super headings of each day of the week afterward. So that's how I came upon making this terrible thing happen to some of my characters. Yeah, sometimes we need to be reminded of how lucky we are to be alive. Yeah. And sometimes it takes something terrible. Often it does, unfortunately.
I think that's really interesting in the context also of how quickly, for whatever reason, whatever human passion, it gets tapped into, whether it's patriotism or jingoism of some kind or whatever sort of definition of the other we can do for ourselves to have us rushing into battle against others of our same species. It's really interesting to me that the psychologists are discovering the same neuronal and hormonal types of responses in the body that make for, meaning of life, passionate feeling of being alive with those who are taking life, those who are in battle, those who are engaged in warfare, experience very much that sort of thrill of life. And they come back many times with this PTSD that we're talking about these days. A lot of that is related to people coming back and not being able to relate to life without that sense of that danger, that immediacy that your life might not go on from this point forward.
I'm also reminded of Haruki Murakami's best-selling novel, Norwegian Wood. I don't know if any of you have read that. It revolves around suicides and premature deaths. And most interestingly to our discussion, I think, is his novel really illustrates the fact that abrupt physical death is nearly always accompanied by a second, longer, and even more painful form of death that takes place in the mind of a survivor who's lost his or her loved one. And it's this process of forgetting that becomes an equivalent to death while the memory of the past love gradually fades over time. And this is an element I see exemplified beautifully in your work, Lorraine, where the struggle is to really retain a visceral remembrance of the one who is lost, where the grief of those left behind becomes itself the central theme of the work. So I'm wondering, did the writing of A Constellation of Ghosts help you uncover anything new or unexpected about the topic or about yourself?
I think what Constellation of Ghosts did for me was it helped me understand how much unresolved grief I was still carrying for the death of my dad, which was 30 some years ago at the time of the writing of the book. The impetus for the book was my colon cancer diagnosis. And even with all that I've studied and practiced in terms of grief and grief theory in my work, I was surprised that that diagnosis still unpacked things that were still buried from farther back in my life.
So almost like an ancestral trauma or behavior patterns that are clung to unconsciously, perhaps.
I think so. And the ancestral trauma and intergenerational patterning was something that I really did look at in my work. My father had polio as a child and he was in an iron lung. He got out of it. He won. He survived that. So we didn't talk about that. My mother's parents were first generation Americans from Finland, and they were fleeing the Russian, some of the Russian challenges that were happening in the early part of the 20th century. And we didn't talk about that. And then my dad's heart attack when he was 36 in 1976, and I was 8 years old, was another thing that we just didn't talk about. Everything just kept moving forward, even as it was clear that things had significantly changed. And looking at those times from, 20, 30, 40, now 50 years into the future from when I first experienced them, I can really see how we embody the patterns that we lived with and the patterns that our grandparents and great-grandparents, lived with as well. It's another thing I think that story can be really beneficial for in terms of helping to shift. I feel like that was the gift of Constellation of Ghosts for me. It helped me really name those patterns and make conscious decisions about whether or not to move forward with them.
This is something that I wanted to ask Lorraine. because of the focus so much on the grief aspect of this, mortality and the end sort of discussion that we're having. And it has to do with some of the stuff I stumbled upon, particularly with when Stephen Jenkinson starts talking about, death and living with death and living with grief. And he has this quote that I wanted to run by you or characterization that I wanted to run by you, where he says that gratitude is the mother of grief. That basically his point being that we cannot grieve what we've never loved. We grieve because we love. And that basically gratitude comes from being had by life. In other words, from having had life. And it is not from being spared from the grief of life. So he really puts a very positive spin on grief. And I'm just curious if that resonates with you at all.
It does to a point. I think that grief is more than just the loss of someone that we love, though. Grief is an emotional response. It's actually a stress response that occurs whenever there's a change in a familiar pattern of behavior. So we can have a grief response to getting married, leaving behind the life that we had before. We can have a grief response to graduating, to divorce, to empty nesters, to illnesses, to all the things that we kind of think about would be more associated with grief. But I think it's a little bit broader for me than that. But something that he does say, I believe it's Stephen Jenkinson who says, he says that grief is a skill. And that does really resonate with me. I don't think that we go through, everyone, goes through grief in the same way at all. But I think that there are tools that can help, just like you would practice anything. And that's the value, again, in having a fireside conversation about grief. Any space where you do come into the world of grief, it's even in the language, there's grief is the internal response to the loss. Mourning is the external response to the loss. You enter into a state of bereavement. That's the noun. It's like a house. You go into this liminal space when you're experiencing this. And if you don't know the landscape and you don't know what ways you might be able to navigate the space, you're even more, I think, floating and lost than you might be. I mean, we do a real disservice, I feel, by not, having open conversations about the normalcy of grief. It is part of being alive. And absolutely, David, what you were saying, I mean, I think it does help us find that gratitude. It helps us really appreciate the gifts and the relationships and the love and the things. And I feel like that really came home for a lot of people when COVID first hit as well. It's like, look at what we used to be able to do that now we miss. People miss smaller things. And that was, I think, a big kind of cultural surprise.
Hearing what you were talking about, I'm sorry to interject, but I just wanted to throw this last little tidbit in from the Jenkinson discussion and reading that I was doing, is that you were talking about the internal response and the external response. And he was talking to an indigenous shaman about this idea of loss and grief. And the shaman told a story about having lost a son. And his final comment was, "I have a hole in my heart and I don't want it to heal."
Yeah, so much to think about, Lorraine, with what you said. My father's experience was fairly similar to your father's, in that he had a couple of heart attacks when I was a kid and didn't really understand. Always thought the heart was going to be the thing that got him, and then he died at 58 of lymphoma instead. He's always there in the background with everything I write. I'm also thinking about what you said about going through grief for any kind of a loss, because my book clearly is about the loss of a neighborhood way of life. And I always find myself feeling nostalgic, feeling as if I was born nostalgic, but I think it's such a suspect concept, nostalgia, and yet you do grieve. Things are being lost all the time in front of you. Just this past season, I had three fairly good friends all lose their spouses unexpectedly. And I'm thinking about how we learn to be better at grieving than what we were given from our parents and grandparents. And one thing I've learned is, even though we all feel awkward and don't know what to say to people who are newly grieving, I've learned to kind of leap past that obstacle and throw myself in anyway. And write to my friends or call my friends and give them the opportunity to talk about it if that's what they need to do. And often that is what they need to do. I went up to visit one of the bereaved spouse friends the other day, and I had offered to go and help her organize her apartment and the, you know, the cleaning out of stuff. And instead, I just sat there all morning and let her talk. And clearly that really helped. So it comes down to, it always comes down to, you know, what you do when you're still alive, what you can do for each other. That may be hard to do at first, but when you do it, I think there's tremendous solace in it for all parties.
The big challenge, I think, is that, you know, our culture in general wants to fix things, and you can't fix grief, and you can't fix the death of someone, you know, you can't change that. And so people don't know what to say. You know, it's easy to, you know, and if you've ever had the unfortunate experience of expressing something you're going through on social media and getting all the advice, you know, from of all the different things that people think you should be doing. I mean, it's just human nature to want to offer up something. But in these times of extreme grief, I mean, there is nothing that will change the loss. There's nothing that will make it what it used to be. And so when people are able to do exactly what you were talking about, Michelle, when people are able to hold that space and allow the individual to process, to not process, to have a normal day, to go out for coffee and not talk about it is also fine. You know, it's not, but to be the friend who can keep showing up and not require the griever to have to do all the work to maintain the relationship. That's a real gift that you're giving to your friends.
Oh, that's something I've noticed with a very close childhood friend of mine who died. And I noticed that she was always in the position of having to help her friends through it. She was living it. So she wasn't afraid. And that just feels wrong, that it shouldn't be the dying person's role to have to make everybody else feel okay.
Right. Right. And that comes from, in general, our uncomfortable, you know, our discomfort around it. My stepson, I met him when he was six or seven. Anyway, his grandfather died a couple of years later. And I watched this young boy, like his sister couldn't stay. My husband's sister couldn't stay. So she was an adult. And this 8-year-old boy just sat on the bed with his grandfather while he died. And it was absolutely astonishing. I had never seen that in a child so young. And it just is just a perfect demonstration of the power of just being just a presence. You know, it's not a small thing. It's a really big thing to be able to stay through the dying.
Yeah. And also what you talk about, not shielding a child from it. We try very hard to protect our kids, right? But they're going to have to confront mortality whenever it comes along. And yeah, I always wondered whether I was odd when people died when my kids were young. I would bring them to the funerals and I thought, I shouldn't be doing this, but something inside me is telling me that it's, you know, it's part of the whole cycle, and they need to understand that, and they need to see that a funeral becomes a celebration of the person's life. So there can be joy even in the sadness.
They need the language for it. We treated so many children who were afraid to sleep because they were told that so-and-so went to sleep. You know, all of the euphemisms that we use because we're afraid to use the word dead, it adversely impacts the children. It truly does.
I think it's interesting too, because one of the common themes that has come up in conversation has been a lack of communication, a lack of frank communication about death, right? And the difficulties that ensue. Lorraine, you talked about in Constellation of Ghosts, when you're young and you're trying to figure out what's going on, you know, all of the adult difficulties and awkwardness around dealing with this topic is just not discussed. And one of the things that I really loved about your work is its speculative element, because it approached the subject of death and grieving in unorthodox ways. I mean, I'm reminded of the phrase that starts every children's book, you know, once upon a time. And we talk about introducing our children to the concept of mortality. And literature with this phrase, once upon a time, is rooted in the formulation, right? Dying in transience is its prerequisite. But unlike us, whose bodies are constrained by reality, who are frail and vulnerable to time, time capitulates to fiction. Time becomes its agent, and fiction and physics can cancel out the linear directionality of time, and the timeline in fiction gets to run rampant. And I love this about A Constellation of Ghosts, because you really engage with the speculative elements. And to me, this also heightens the focus on grieving and death. Because just to let me explain better, even though we typically read a novel in one direction from front to back, time in a novel can run backwards or in several directions. One and the same person can be more than one age simultaneously. The literary eye is not necessarily threatened with physical deterioration, even if that eye possesses a body. And I think you work with these speculative elements, Lorraine, to really delve deeply into this theme of death and grieving that perhaps more conventional fiction can't approach quite so intimately. What do you think?
Thank you for that. I appreciate that reflection on the work. I do think that time isn't linear within our bodies either. I mean, we're aging forward, but the stories that we bring up from our childhood, the experiences that we've had in our past are continually informing our present, and they're informing our ability to make future choices as well. So time is really on some kind of loop or some kind of spiral. And then when there's a trauma, that pattern can get locked in and can get really concretized and repeated over and over and over and over again. And that was something that I was deliberately trying to do, was to try to find a way to dramatize that feeling of being stuck in complicated mourning, which is now called prolonged grief disorder, but complicated mourning where you just can't find your way out into another space. You can't find your way into a different way of relating to the world.
Absolutely. It's interesting, too, to consider how mortality impacts our sense of place. And I find this particularly interesting, given our own notions of ascribed longevity to concrete and steel, to collective societies and nation states that seem to be imbued with a continuity that stretches beyond the limits of any one human lifetime. In your novel, David, the town of Marsville is depicted in a slow and steady decline, much like your character of Kelsey, I think. And Michelle, the sense of village is similarly imperiled, as is so poignantly alluded to in the title of your work, Save the Village. So I'd love to hear, Michelle, a little bit more, and then from you, David, about how the role that place plays in your stories and why that matters.
I've lived in the village for a very long time now, and places are always changing, right? Sometimes in huge ways, sometimes in small, dribbling ways. And they're changing in ways that seem better to some people and seem worse to other people. I came to the village and immediately fell in with a bunch of grassroots activists, preservationists, my husband and I. And we became very active in trying to prevent crazy luxury overdevelopment that was taking over our neighborhood. So that's at the genesis of my story. Save the Village was an actual organization that we belong to. It's always happening. It's painful. It's a little death, right? When neighborhood landmarks and fixtures suddenly are no longer there and the people involved with them go away, move on to other things. In Save the Village, I wanted my protagonist to be a prototypical old school bohemian villager living in a fifth floor walk up, the kind of person who's been railing about the village losing its soul since probably the 1960s. We've seen that loss really, really accelerate in the past couple of decades. So yeah, there is that death, and there's that feeling of belonging to a community within the village. You know, there's many, many, many overlapping communities, and I've been lucky to belong to a good number of them. And people die off eventually. The great people who were your mentors in one field or another. In our case, my husband and I, as young burgeoning activists, you know, that generation is mostly gone now. They held on for a very, very long time. And then the fear that nobody's going to come along and take over, that whole way of life is gone. And David, for you and your town, I'm guessing you feel a sort of a similar leaking out of vitality.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about one of the aspects of writing that we're talking about in terms of, particularly in terms of the end and loss, is that basically places that humans have taken on, you know, where they've settled, those places take on the humans and the humans take on those places, right? So I find it really interesting how people reflect their place and so that a place can come to represent different things. So in the femme fatale hypothesis, Marsville becomes metaphorical as much as real and becomes very representative of the fact that these things are all temporal, right? These, you know, like even graveyards get dug up and, you know, transformed, and there's nothing permanent about our settlements in the long run. You know, everything's constantly changing, buildings being torn down, blocks being replaced, and homes, you know, farmland turning to homelands, right? I think basically when it comes to these establishment of places, your characters in real life, you know, people bring their own biases, baggage, you know, alliances, you know, their perception of where they live to bear in their daily life. And I think your characters do too. If you, like you were talking earlier, Janie, about time in novels, I think place is very important as part of the palette in novels as well, because, you know, we develop these personal relationships with our surroundings, and they can, different people characterizing those same surroundings very differently. And so that really intrigued me as an idea to play through in the novel. What's the difference between the way Kelsey Geddes perceives his environment and the way June perceives it? And June's view of the world is much grander than Kelsey's. Kelsey's is very myopic and is very centered on his wife and his own little world. And he just starts looking out his window and his world starts to expand a little bit. June, on the other hand, comes from the community. She has a church affiliation and she has a birding group, and she gets out of her house, and she had a family that was very much active in this community for a long time. And all these things are changing. Her relationship with the church is changing. Her kids have moved to California. So watching that all take place, you know, articulating that within the context of June's relationship with the Geddes was important to me, because I wanted to get at this notion of, you know, nothing is static, even in this little small town. We talk about quaint. We talk about, you know, talk about all these different things. Look at the rivers up the Delaware, here in where I live. All these quaint little towns that everybody thinks are sort of frozen in place. Well, far from it. I mean, you try to rent a place in Lambertville, New Jersey now. It's ridiculous, you know. So things are constantly changing, and I love the fact that place can become not only, you know, very real in terms of placing your people in a time in history and placing them in a particular geography and placing them in an environment that they have to relate to, but also it can be very strongly metaphorical about the breakdown, loss, and decay that can take place in a place just like a person.
Yes. And of course, the village that I'm writing about is going through the opposite of what Marsville is going through. It was largely a bit of a ghetto until recent decades, when people with more wealth moved in to the townhouses and restored them all. And the historic district was formed in the 60s. You end up with this kind of unsolvable problem of when is a neighborhood just right for whom is it just right? And so, you know, the wealth comes in, and with it comes more wealth, right? That property values go up and the place is cleaner and the place is safer. And so I often find myself in this ridiculous sort of situation of yearning for when it was scuzzy and awful, right? But full of life. And so I suppose that's part of why I created my two main characters, the nemeses, Becca, who represents everything that's the old village, and Melora, who came along in the 80s and who got wealthy and bought a whole townhouse. Their properties are joining, they're on different blocks, but their backyards face each other. So it was a lot of fun for me to have these two kind of representative types, but who I tried to make very real people with multiple dimensions. I suppose that's part of the joy of the novel, that you get to play with time, that it doesn't have to go only in one direction, and you also get to play with people and all the different things that they can be at the same time.
You know, on the metaphor side, I have to ask you, was it a conscious metaphorical choice on your part to have Melora's foundation of her townhouse breaking down?
I don't know if it was conscious, but but it was certainly there in my mind. Yeah. It was kind of pleasing.
I thought that was great.
with sewage rushing in.
Michelle, I'd love it if you could share an excerpt with us. Do you have a reading prepared?
So let's see. What do people need to know? This comes late in the novel. There's been multiple deaths of a group of women from the same community who are all good friends. This particular excerpt is told from the point of view of Mark, who's one of the mourning husbands. And he's just, well, you'll see, it's the group memorial that's about to occur. The mourners had filled the lot and were parked on either side of the street and on the asphalt island not meant for parking. There seemed to be 1,000 Chevys in the parking lot, wearing the same frown on their grills, all tisking as they tried to cool down in the hot rain. The magnolias were crying, the sweet gums dropping their weaponry for little girls to cut their tender feet on. The umbrellas hadn't heard the dirge and tried to cheer everybody up with their polka dots and their Monets and even a map of the New York City subway system. Oh God, Mark asked himself, who could be under that one? He couldn't remember how he got there or in what car. He always noticed the car he was in. He was always the driver. They entered the church the back way, past the gleaming stainless kitchen. The first person he saw inside was Trudy, the kitchen lady, lit from behind like a diabetic Madonna. Trudy, who had catered their daughter Lexi's communion, who received his wife Jackie's famous eggplant casserole, and Laura's famous sticky buns, and on down the line of their friends, except for Cheryl, whose only famous recipe involved a punch bowl and a fifth of Jack Daniels. He blundered straight into Trudy like an airbag. Save me, oh Trudy, he thought. This being alive, how dogged it was, how he hated it. He had always followed Jackie everywhere she went. Sometimes he'd follow her into the bathroom, though she always shooed him out and told him a lady needed her privacy. The rain got heavier and noisier on the roof. He made it past the restrooms and the water cooler and reached the wood that marked the beginning of the sanctuary. He peeked in and saw lipstick and hairdos and much tailored suiting. It was hushed and yet very loud. Bodies in pews receding to the horizon. He was having trouble matching up faces and names and contexts. Which one is the cleaning lady who had taken direction from Jackie for 20 years? And which one the head of personnel at her office? His mechanic, his mailman, his across-the-street neighbor, his second cousin. Names bounced through his mind. Norm and Manuel and someone was holding his arm. Someone was always holding his arm now and directing him, and he followed, though he was tempted to fling the hand away with a violent motion that would terrify Lexi or his mother-in-law or the usher. It was a long way to the first pew. The wood was so dark and shiny. In the rain, the rose window had gone yellowish. The church was gasping for breath. The priest, Father Briggs, he recalled that name. He, Mark, was in the brig for a life sentence. There didn't seem to be much difference between a life and a death sentence.
Lovely.
Thank you.
You know, an interesting thing that occurred to me as David was talking so eloquently about change and the constant inexorable process of change, which affects people and places. And I think the other thing that's quite marvelous about literature, paradoxically, is also its ability to stop time. What I was thinking about was the Diary of Anne Frank, because even though she doesn't die during the diary, the story, as the reader experiences it now, is filled with a sense of mortality, because we know she dies at Belsen. But in her diary, she's young and alive and forever frozen to this certain moment. And I think her seeming immortality in this story, at the story level, shows the fragility of human life and makes her story a constant source of mourning and memorialization. So in this way, the mere consciousness of mortality can give any novel a sense of determinism. And this ability to freeze life to a certain moment and the stillness, you know, can give characters and their lives and their stories a certain immortality. And I felt this very poignantly when I was reading Lorraine's work, particularly, Lorraine, when you describe your father's childhood in North Carolina, you know, right before he contracted polio, and then the life of his mother after your father has left home. And there is this stillness, because you describe these moments so beautifully that the reader can experience them viscerally and immersively. So it does feel like a living snapshot that you've captured this moment in time that becomes timeless in putting it to paper.
Yeah, I think that that's part of what's amazing about literature and about what it's able to do for the reader. I think that being able to find those kind of snapshot or flashbulb memories and moments, those are the ones that I think a character, whether it's in memoir, whether it's in fiction, is going to be taking and using as a blueprint for the life and the challenges that they're going to have moving forward. And to be able to kind of go back in and revisit some of those moments and some of those experiences, to kind of go back to what we were talking about in the beginning, helped me to find a way to deconcretize some of that stuckness and move through some of the grieving process.
Mm-hmm. Because of course, for the living, that's life, isn't it? I mean, composed of moments, one after the other.
Mm-hmm.
Lorraine, do you have a section of a Constellation of Ghosts that you'd like to read for us today?
I do. And this is actually, it kind of ties in to what you were just asking. This is toward the very beginning, and it's the first part of the book that's called The Play at the Ancestral Realm. It's the part where my father is speaking through the conceit of a raven. And this is the scene where I'm watching him die in the hospital room, which was, of course, something that I was present at. But it's from his perspective as he's transitioning to death and then to becoming that raven. I think that's all that anyone would need to know. So this is about midway through that short scene. And this is all from his perspective. When you are about to burst with breath and depth, you know it will only be a few moments, and you want to resist, like how you, daughter, wanted to resist the anesthesia before surgery, but always it is stronger. It is a tidal wave at the edge of your consciousness, and you surrender to it without trying to, even if for a moment you plan to anchor your defiant feet in the shifting sand. I wanted to reach to you, but we had not been a tactile family, too much Lutheran, too much Baptist, too much discomfort with the messiness of flesh. But I knew in that final dermal moment that to touch the skin of another was to touch the face of the God I had long wrestled with. To touch the flesh of another was to hold the very miracle of the cosmos, that 98.6 degree fire threading through us all. I wanted you to touch me too, but I knew the beeping scared you, the thick restraints on my wrists, the unconscious thrashing of my body that was trying to kick loose my soul. I was breaking free of my bone cage at the same time I was reaching for you, and the full moon tide was coming, and I could taste the salt spray on my lips, and she smelled of life, and my body twisted, and I tugged at my chains like a Victorian ghost, but they were not chains at all, only flaccid representations of the human hope of permanence. The nurse had brought you into my room that morning. Alone, you were alone, only 19, only alone, and she told you I was leaving, and you watched like you had watched me from the moment you opened your eyes, from your curl in the crib to your petulant high school pout, to this instant where we found ourselves on opposite sides of the river. I watched your birth passage, thrashing and bloody and dark, and you watched my death slide, and I wondered for a blink who was waiting for me to emerge, flesh suit shed, shimmering sparkle of dust, and I wanted to bring you with me, not to take your life from you, no, but to take my very best thing with me, my daughter, I wish so much I could have stayed, could have saved you. So I struck a bargain like Robert Johnson, song and guitar at the Delta Crossroads. Just a little bit more time, just a little bit, you see. My daughter, she will need me soon. But the full moon tide kept rising. It's heard this song before, so much before, that it has a response. Can I get an amen? Amen. Can I get an amen? Who wants to be saved? I do. Who wants to turn it over now? I do. The tide is rising. The salt is churning. The undertow has wrapped its fingers around me, and I have 1 second left to memorize your face. No lines yet. No lines, no gray. And I watch you swallow my tide lapping at the muggy air in the sterile room, gulping your own rising tide back, squeezing your eyes closed to hold the water line at bay. You are watching me, still tossing on the bed. You are watching me, slipping out behind my lips into the fluorescent room. You are watching me, last gasp, death rattle, only the shaking off of the lost tendons that held me to my house, my lungs, my spleen, my liver, my kidneys, my useless leg, my heart, my heart, how well you have done for all that you have suffered through. How well you have done, my daughter, drink me in this moment, our moment, please, please, just a little more time. I come to the crossroads. I come. I come.
Wow. Goosebumps. I'm struck, Lorraine, listening to you read, by the cadence, by the lyricism. I mean, it seems to me a song of dying. It's so poetic.
Yeah. And I actually found out, thank you, 23andMe, that I, on my mother's side, I'm descendant from Karelian lamenters in Finland, who were people who literally their work in life was to lament the dead and dying in their community. And then I grew up in the American South. So I have that rhythm of that particular space as well.
One last topic I'd like to just touch on briefly, if you all can linger with me a little bit longer, is, you know, it's such a dark topic to take on. And as we've talked about, you know, a fearful one for so many. What role does humor have to play in this? I mean, where do you bring a little bit of light in the narrative? And is that important?
Oh, wherever you can, right? Always.
Is that something you're consciously sort of thinking about at all in writing these works? Or is it something that manifested, you know, without conscious effort?
Well, in my case, I think you let it bubble up where it will. It's got to be fun, this process, right? Wrestling this monster into shape and grappling with dark themes. It's sort of inevitable. And, you know, I feel as if my ancestors rise up in me, and they're Eastern European Jews with their gallows humor. And yeah, that always makes itself felt in whatever I write.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's not so much you attempt to at humor. It's just that the characters in the story don't know that they're engaged in this dark theme. They're just living their lives. And I've just tried to create characters who had a certain sense of humor about their life. They had a wonderful relay. Rose and Kelsey are always joking around because that's just the relationship that they have. So there's lightness there. There's attempts by Kelsey to lighten things at times when he's feeling a little bit out of sorts with his level of control over his situation. So yeah, there's always opportunities for lightness, but that comes from the characters themselves, you know, not in contrast to the theme, but just in deference to the characters themselves. They have to have full lives. If there's no laughter in their lives, why would we care that their lives are passing before us?
Mm-hmm, certainly.
And David, your Kelsey and Rose have such different kinds of senses of humor, even though they share their jokes. But that was a great pleasure. I found that Kelsey was kind of corny and Rose is very sharp.
Indeed. I would just like to go back one second to what you said earlier, Jane, because you were talking about this whole concept of mortality and immortality when you were getting into talking to Lorraine more about what inspired her work. And I just think it's important for us to realize, at least as far as we know, the way that we perceive the world and from our sense of these beings around us, we seem to be just about the only being who has this concept where we have this awareness of our own mortality, but also this concept of infinity. So this finitude contrasting with this infinity that we see out there, and this somehow this feeling that time doesn't have to end for us, that as long as we can see, we can conceive of immortality, we can somehow achieve it. And I think that's a really interesting subject to broach with creative writing, just this idea of contrasting our mortality with our immortality and how that comes to play out in our lives.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Thank you, David. It's a very interesting thought.
Let me add one more thing to that. Just when you're talking about contrast and the tension between them, what I love so much about fiction, that it took me a long time to learn about fiction, that it gets its power from the tension between opposites. And so I suppose that's one reason we have all been drawn to death as a subject, because it inherently creates this tension with, you know, those who are leading their lives, staying alive, and surviving, and maybe getting unstuck as a result of other people dying. It makes for good storytelling, I think.
There's also, I think, the ability to look back at other works of art from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago and still find comfort, you know, still find a companion, still find a friend to walk through the life that we're living today. And that, to me, is nothing short of miraculous.
I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to be our guests and just reiterate how delightful this discussion has been. And I've so enjoyed it. And I hope you three have too.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, very much. What lovely company to be in.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Lorraine and Michelle, thank you very much for being here. And thank you for having us, Jane.
Thank you, David, Lorraine, and Michelle. For all those listening in, The Femme Fatale Hypothesis, The Constellation of Ghosts, A Speculative Memoir with Ravens, and Save the Village are all available for order on our website at www.regalhousepublishing.com. The very best way to support an indie press is to buy books directly from their website, and we are so very grateful for your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might want to tune in again for our next episode, taking a deep dive into middle grade literature with Ginger Park, Diana Wren, and Frank Morelli. In the meantime, from all of us at Regal, keep reading.